This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Hey, welcome into All Ball. I'm your host, Doug Gottlieb. We really appreciate you downloading, subscribing, and rating this here podcast. This one's going to be a little bit of a long one, so buckle up. We're going to continue to evolve the pod during the off season, and because there really is no off season. Last week we talked a lot of high school hoops and some recruiting. This week we'll talk some college hoops. Chris Beard from Texas Tech is going to join me, and I don't want to do the let's talk about your players. We'll talk a little bit about the Elite Eight, a little bit about, you know, losing a one and done, first time ever. Texas Tech and Chris Beard have lost a one and done. What I want to get to is his kind of mercurial path from being a high school ball player that was set to go to like a D2 NAIA level school and went to Texas, thought about going back to playing in an NAIA school, finished up at Texas, became a very young assistant coach. So what I want to get to with Chris Beard is his path to becoming not only a head coach, but a really good one. He's super interesting, you know. He's a great storyteller. Plus, there's some Bob Knight to it, right? Like, don't you want Bob Knight stories? Of course you want Bob Knight stories. I love Bob Knight stories. Before he joins us, I'm going to give you a Bob Knight story of my own. One of the things in the feedback that many of you guys have given me, tell us more stories. Okay, here's the story. When I was getting to be a freshman, at Notre Dame, I got invited to the U.S. trials. And it was like the under-19 trials. Matter of fact, it's funny because Tim Duncan was a sophomore, maybe going to be a junior. He was really young, and I was an old high school senior. And so he could have played in maybe it was the 18 and under or something like that. And he actually played up because he was just so much better than everybody. He played like the 21 and under, the 20 and under, and I was on the 18 and under. I don't remember how it worked. So I was friends with a guy named Charlie Miller. Charlie Miller's nickname is Fluke. He's from Miami, Florida. He actually played for Frank Martin, and he played for Miami Senior High School. Anyway, so Fluke had come out and stayed at my house and played on my AAU team the summer before. This is back when you could play kind of out-of-area stuff. So we used to fly guys in every summer to load up our team. And Charlie's a great dude. He had just completed his freshman year at Indiana. And then Brian Evans was also there. And so I kind of befriended Brian Evans and Charlie. And I was, you know, like little brother to both of them hanging out around the USA trials. So in basketball, and a lot of you guys are coaches or players, and you know this, but one of the things that when you play for or work for a vivid personality, like a good icebreaker is give me a story, right? Give me a, you know, if you played with a guy who was a whack job, give me a, what's it called? You know, give me a story. And so I never forget, I said, you know, give me a story about Coach Knight. And at the time, the story was this, that they were coming back from Iowa, playing on the road at Iowa, and Indiana's team plane had a chair for Bob Knight up in the front, and it could spin around and face the rest of the team. And they lost to Iowa, and Coach Knight had a bowl of fruit, and he was stewing over his bowl of fruit, looking at the stat sheet, and he turned around to look at the team, and he starts reading the stat line, and every negative stat that he would read, he'd pick up a piece of fruit and throw it at one of the players. Greg Graham, 5 turnovers. Are you freaking kidding me? And he starts throwing fruit at Greg Graham. And then, of course, the manager's like, what are you supposed to do? You go and you get the fruit. You reload Coach so that he has his fruit because he wants to eat it or he wants to throw it again. So there's a famous video out there of Coach Knight getting run over. Most coaches have been run over at practice. And that is gold, right? The coach is yelling and screaming, and he forgets that we're transitioning offense to defense. And, you know, some of these dudes, they get into their 40s, 50s, 60s. Sometimes they trip. Sometimes they're just old. Sometimes it just surprises them, and they fall, or they just get run over. Because, you know, if you're playing offense, and all of a sudden the shot goes up, and he's on your ass to get back. Get your ass back on defense. You turn, you sprint, and, oh, there's Coach! So supposedly also, and one of the other stories was, that there was a film that they had commandeered from the managers of Coach Knight getting run over at practice, and they enjoyed it so much that when they'd have a bad day, they would all go over to Brian Evans' apartment and run it incessantly over and over and over again. Let's watch it again. So we'll have some Bob Knight stories and some other stories upcoming with Chris Beard. The hoop I want to get to real quick in terms of the NBA is many people reacting now as it's set in that LeBron James is going to be a member of the LA Lakers. Now, look, you don't have to agree with my opinion. It's okay. And it's not such a strong opinion that it's like, this is absolutely the right way and there's no wrong way. I've said for a long time that Michael Jordan is to the greatest player I've ever seen play basketball. And the struggle I've had with LeBron, and this is more previous to this year because he had a little bit more of this, has been that in any basketball game I ever played in, especially like pickup games, and this is kind of the way the NBA has always been. You get down game on the line, you get the ball to your best player, and you get the hell out of the way, and he's going to go get you a bucket, right? And I understand that LeBron James is wired to set people up, and he's an incredible passer. He's a really good passer. But there was something about the killer instinct that at times he would defer. And while that's great in big situations, you know, it's not always great. That's great in some situations, not always great in the biggest of situations, as opposed to Jordan, who had to learn to pass, as opposed to Kobe had to, I don't know if he ever truly learned to trust his teammates, but he did trust Derek Fisher, and Derek Fisher made him look good. I do think there's some genius to him. And it was to LeBron and how he plays, but Larry Bird didn't have to learn to pass to score down the stretch. Magic Johnson didn't either. So however you regard LeBron James as the greatest player of all time, the greatest player of this era, I'm okay saying he's the greatest player of this era, even if I thought Kevin Durant in many ways outplayed him in both the past two NBA finals. And I actually think that LeBron James is living a lot on reputation defensively. And Kevin Durant, though his defense wasn't as good most of the season as it was at the start of the year and in the playoffs, he has shown the desire to play more defense than he ever did. So whether or not I think he's the best player now, or the second best player, it's inarguable over the last decade he's been consistently the best or one of the top three players in the NBA, right? We were okay with that? Cool. So he goes to the Lakers, and now people are being critical in many ways, saying, look, Barkley said he wants to be a mogul, and everybody's saying it's not about winning. And look, I don't think it's solely about winning, but I think that winning is part of the equation. It's just not the only part of the equation. Family, location, weather, ability to do something after basketball. Like, you know, I think he's an incredibly well-rounded guy. Now, that may not fit your narrative or what you want for your athletes. And it's interesting because Kobe has found this second passion, right? Here's Kobe Bryant, a guy who a lot of people thought, man, he is just not going to be able to cope. He's not going to be able to cope with not having basketball. And he's already won, you know, an Oscar. So we were so scared that Kobe wouldn't know what to do with himself. And at some of the Kobe's curious. He's very bright. And some of it, I think, was helped out by the fact that he had the year off when he had the Achilles tendon surgery and the rehab. You know, people think you rehab 24 hours a day. You don't. Kobe also spent more time as a father, you know, started a program for his daughters, both of them soccer, then basketball. And he started to develop other interests. LeBron has other interests. And he's still a great player. He's what you understand when you're in a business is like what you understand as a student. Like, remember when you first got to college and you were just overwhelmed by like, oh, I got all these classes. I got all the syllabus to keep up with and the reading and the homework and the tests. And, oh, yeah, by the way, I'm trying to have a social life. And for me, it was lifting and basketball and eating and being away from home. Like, your time management skills suck. 3 years into college, your time management skills are awesome. That's no different than now. He's a machine. Guy's a machine. Gets up. Most of these guys get up. They work out early. I'll give you an example. Gordon Hayward, I know this for a fact. Gordon Hayward gets up at 5. He's at his workout place at 6. From 6 to 7, he works on his body, lifting, running, whatever his trainer has him do. And then from 7 to 8, he works on his game. And then he's done. Doesn't touch the basketball the rest of the day. That's his off-season routine. And so from 8 until whenever, Gordon Hayward is just a dad. Right? He's just a dad. As we found out, he's going to be the dad of another daughter, but he's just a dad. Well, that's the same for LeBron. Like, these guys, they understand how to manage their time. You know, they have drivers, they have chefs, they have trainers, they have guys that just stretch them and take care of their body. And within that other time, within that downtime, he's past the video game playing stage, you know? He's past the staring at his phone stage. So, yeah, he can be a mogul, but he can also still be a great basketball player. I don't think what Charles Barkley is saying is wrong. I think he is on the downward side of his career, but he's still kind of in the downward side of his prime, right? He hasn't hit the, oh my God, Jason Kidd can't make a layup stage. He's not close to that. He's managed the mileage on his odometer better than anybody in the history, maybe of any sport. That's what's really remarkable about him. So, look, it's thrown people for a loop, but we all kind of knew it was coming. The roster is a little bit different than you thought, but as I've stated previously on my radio show, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific, the Doug Gottlieb Show, Fox Sports Radio, there was no blank slate. You can't create a team out of nothing, and based on what was available, this was the path that they've chosen. Let's get some junkyard dogs, experienced guys off the bench, and see what the young guys got. And so as we react to LeBron James, is it a surefire championship team? No. But I also think he's a builder. People like the build. Here's the housing analogy. You know, some people like to buy a really sick house that somebody else redid and just live in it and enjoy life. Some people like going in and buying, excuse my language, but a shitter. You know, you go in and you buy something that needs it, and they like to, whether they scrape it or they just redo the kitchens and the bathroom and the tile and they paint everything. And then, you know, they're in it for a couple years and they're like, now we made profit. Let's sell it. Let's move on. Let's move down the street and do the exact same thing. That's who LeBron James is. He likes to redo things. So we knew it was coming. It was a little bit harder than people will allow us to believe with Magic. Remember, Magic walked in and Paul George wasn't coming. He had to explain that one away. Even if they had cooled on Paul George and some people saw it coming, the fact is that you're getting ready to have a meeting. You're the only one that has a meeting. And all you got to do is make the wide open jump shot. And Paul George decides he's staying in Oklahoma City. That had to be somewhat of a surprise. So they close the deal, and now everybody reacts. I'll also point out this in regards to the NBA. And this is really important, I think. In regards to the NBA, the Oklahoma City Thunder, I think, got better, more so than anyone outside of the Lakers. They refined their roster. First, getting Paul George back. Year two, he is going to be better. You are more comfortable. You know how to play within the offense, even if they restructure things. You have a better relationship with Russell Westbrook. You know how that... You're just more comfortable. Year two in a college, year two in a job, you're just more comfortable. Getting rid of Carmelo Anthony, who they couldn't hide defensively, and they needed to feed the basketball to and get him shots, that's better. Remember, they get Andre Roberson back, who they love because he's such a versatile defender and he has no ego offensively, albeit he's got to make some, he's got to make a shot in order to keep people honest. And then I really like the acquisition of going out and getting Dennis Schroeder. Schroeder's not a great starting point guard. He's probably bottom 5 to 7 in terms of the starting point guards in the league. Not great. But as a backup, as a sixth man who can move Russell Westbrook off the ball, that's a great get. It's a really, really good get. So, again, not working with a blank slate, having Russell Westbrook. Do they have enough shooting around him? I don't know. You got Paul George. You still got Brinus. You got the ability to go small with Grant. And now you get another guard who can defend the basketball and who can get in the lane and create shots for himself and for others. For others is a bit of a question mark. I like it. I think Oklahoma City is going to challenge to be the second best team in the West. Whether or not they have the second best record in the West, that doesn't really matter. Oklahoma City is going to be a tough out, a really, really tough out. And I'm fascinated to see what happens with the Thunder. In regards to the NCAA for college basketball, we wait and wait and wait. And we'll find out what the new recruiting rules, what the new calendar looks like. But it does look like it's going to be a combination of the recommendations of the committee and the recommendations of college coaches. I don't know how these camps work, these massive camps run by NBA people and NCAA people and somehow taking shoe companies out of it. I hope to be involved. They call me. I may make a call. I'd like to be involved. I think it'd be great for guys that love the game that don't have a specific tie to a specific shoe company or specific AAU program that's been on the take. I like that. But I also think it keeps the AAU teams going. There'll still be the Peach Jam. There'll still be the Gauntlet. There'll still be other events as well. I don't think that'll die. And I think April recruiting period is important. I like the idea of getting high school coaches involved. But I also like the idea of keeping college coaches more engaged with their own current players. If it was me, if I was setting the rules would be there are no rules. Right. Instead of having condensed weekends where you can come out and see kids, just look, if you want to go on the road, recruit, go on the road and recruit. If you're a recruiting assistant coach, you should be allowed to go out whenever you want. This idea that you're going to bombard players and be around them too much. If you're around a kid too much and he wants space, he's going to eliminate you from recruiting him. Everybody likes attention. They don't like creepy attention. So to me, I'm a less rules is more. Don't pay your players. Don't change their grades. You know, don't pay people who are going to pay the players. And don't encourage anybody else to change their grades. That's kind of it. I know there's got to be a couple more rules than that, but that's about it for me. But we'll wait to see what happens. We'll start to preview college basketball as well. We continue to update you on NBA stuff. Dwight Howard, by the way, saying this is bouncing back to the NBA, saying that the Warriors called. I do think the Warriors wanted a big guy. They wanted to get a big guy in the cheap. They got DeMarcus Cousins. They thought they could get Dwight Howard, and then Cousins called him and kind of surprised them. The difference with Cousins and Howard is Cousins is more in his prime and can shoot the basketball, but he's not going to play until March. Howard can't shoot and is also kind of a weird fit with the personality of that team, although he's a guy who likes to have fun, and they like to have fun playing. But playing style-wise, he could be an odd fit, especially considering the minutes would be limited that he'd get there. But the money that he got in Washington was the money that he would get in Golden State, so it's reasonable to think they called, and then he was usurped and moved. He was passed over when they went and got DeMarcus Cousins. That's my read on some of the NBA stuff. We mentioned some of the college basketball rules. One last thing, Zion Williamson weighs in at 285 pounds. He's 6'5 and change, 285 pounds. Dude, this is, he's a tank, but he's got to slim up. Because as explosive as an athlete as he is, and he's explosive, it's his ability to make it at the next level is going to be, is he agile enough to move out on the floor? He's going to have to be an undersized foreman. They're going to have to shoot a little bit better, but that's going to come with work ethic. Got to learn to play harder on defense. But he has the God-given athletic ability, but he needs to be playing in the 250s, 260s. You almost wish whatever Villanova does with those guys to slim down, that's what Duke should do. So as I'm getting ready for the Duke, Kentucky's, maybe even Carolina if they figure out their point guard situation, UCLA should be loaded. College basketball is going to be a lot of fun this year to cover. Obviously, a whole new team at Villanova since seemingly their entire team went in the first round of the NBA draft. Keep an eye on Zion Williamson, who is a YouTube sensation, but watch for his weight, watch for his movement defensively, and whether or not he can shoot the basketball. I think his basketball IQ is good enough. It's going to be more about his basketball motor. All right, let's get you to Chris Peters. All right, let's roll on here on the All Ball podcast as we talk basketball all the time. I don't know. As soon as we started doing this pod, one of the first, like 10 people that came to my mind in terms of just the name, like All Ball, which is all basketball all the time, was the head coach of Texas Tech. He's had an incredible run starting out as an assistant, kind of working his way up through the different levels of coaching to becoming not only doing a spectacular job at Little Rock, but then Texas Tech for in just two seasons. I mean, think about this, 141 and 54. 141 and 54. That's his record so far. He's been the champion of the Sun Belt. Of course, he was coach of the year in the Big 12. He was coach of the year in the Sun Belt. I mean, you go back and look at his resume, and it is it's just one of incredible growth, but it's also a guy who, the more you get to know him, the more you know he kind of is all ball all the time. Chris Beard joins us here on the podcast. Is that fair? Like, do you have, if you had to pick your three other interests outside of basketball, and you can't say your girls, what would they be?
Well, that's a tough one, man, because I was going to go down the daughter avenue and the girlfriend street, but can we still say girlfriend is one of the three, or just
that's fine? I mean, listen, women in your life would be one, right? If there was two, okay. And there's three, yeah. Like, do you fish? Do you hunt? Do you like rehabbing houses? Do you like the market? Like, what would two and three be if it wasn't for basketball?
You know, none of those things. I did used to play golf early in my career, but I have not swung a golf club since I met Bob and Pat Knight. True story. used to play, not all the time, but I'd play like, you know, once a week or something. But then once I got here to Tech as an assistant, not that those guys wouldn't let me play golf, just kind of like trying to prioritize time and things like that. I've got kind of a competitive, almost, you know, addictive personality, so I'm almost scared to go play because I know I'll get the bug again. But yeah, after women in my life, I'd have to say, you know, one thing I try to do a lot is I go to a lot of movies. That kind of started in my single coaching days. I'd always go to like the 10 o'clock p.m. movie, no matter what was showing. Kind of a time to turn the phone off and just relax a little bit, let your mind go somewhere besides basketball. And I've still continued to do that. It's very rare that there's a movie out that I haven't seen. Huh. And then thirdly, you know, I don't know, maybe watching NBA basketball.
that still qualifies as basketball. All right, so.
No, it's different. It's different, Doug. Different than college basketball.
I do think it is different. I do think, and I want to get to that in a second. Look, we could sit here and kind of run down your guys' Elite Eight run, but I don't know. I mean, that would be the VCR going through your mind. I think it's far more interesting how you got to where you are, how you develop your philosophy, and how you continue to evolve as a coach. I think to people who love basketball, that's fascinating. All right, so let's go back. McCullough High School, right? That's and then you go to you say, I want to go to Texas because of Tom Penders, and I want to be part of that staff, and I want to learn ball. Or why'd you go to UT?
Yeah, so my journey growing up, you know, I kind of played everything, football, baseball, basketball, like everybody, whatever season was in session is kind of where your love was. And then right around the time, like junior high school, I kind of made a commitment in high school just to play basketball and really just fell in love with the sport for so many reasons, the locker room, the camaraderie, the competitiveness. You know, it was always hard to get enough people in the neighborhood together to play football or even baseball, but basketball, you can kind of even play with yourself, you know, imagination, driveway, the whole deal.
Yeah, I used to do that.
Two great high school coaches. Mike Kuhnstadt was my first high school coach in Irving, Texas. Coach Kuhnstadt, now one of the best recruiting service events guy out there with Great American Sports in Texas. And then at McCullough, playing for Terry Priest, the Texas High School Hall of Fame coach. Those guys really mentored me. I'd say second to my own father, those guys have probably had the most influence in my life. I was set to go play like Division Five basketball in a kind of an academic kind of school around Austin, Southwestern University. Not disrespecting those people, I had already paid my application fee and everything. Then there was a coaching change. The coach at the time then went to a Division Two school. I asked that coach, "You know, hey, when do I need to be there?" And he kind of paused and said, "You're not coming here." So reality kind of hit me in the face there, so I decided to go to the University of Texas State School, and then kind of my admiration for Coach Penders and that program. Once I got there, got involved with the team as quick as I could. Took a little bit of a detour during my college years to chase the playing dream again at Concordia Lutheran, where Rusty Siegler was the coach, a really, really good coach in his own right. Went back to Texas.
Slow down. So how long were you at Texas before you decided you want to play? Because my brother did that. He was supposed to go like low D1, and he just couldn't get into it. He got into UCLA. He was supposed to walk on. You know, he got beat out to be a walk-on, and so he's just like a frat boy. Then a couple years in, he's like, "Dude, I want to play." He started working out of the summer with me. He went to JC camps, and he ended up going to Drake as a walk-on. So how many years were you at UT before you went to Concordia?
Yeah, same type story, Doug. It's like an addiction, you know. Like, love of basketball is a disease. There's all of us out here that really weren't very good players that had the disease. So basically at Texas, first year, kind of getting used to school and going down that route, and then really missing basketball. Got back involved with the team second year of college with Coach Penders, Vic Trilli, Eddie Orne, some great guys that really helped my career. And then just playing with the guys in the summer and after practice and stuff, just really started missing it and kind of didn't want to live my life with any kind of regrets. The deal had happened real quick when I didn't go to Southwestern. So got back in decent shape and then had an opportunity to go to Concordia Lutheran, which is actually right there in Austin. Was only there for a summer session. And then right when the school year started back, the coach there, Rusty Siegler, gave me some of the best advice of my life. Like, "Chris, look, you're wanting to coach. What are you doing here? You're about to go in debt." I had to FAFSA out, taking student loans and all sorts of stuff. But with the advice of Rusty Siegler and Tom Penders and those guys, went back to Texas quickly. So was really only at Concordia for one semester.
Okay, so you graduate Texas, and then how long before you went to Incarnate Word?
Yeah, so Incarnate Word was my first job. I was a graduate assistant there with Danny Casper, who's now the head coach of Texas State.
Yeah, really good
Steve
coach.
Lutz. Who's done a great job in his career. He's at Purdue now with Coach Painter. I think he's a future head coach very soon. Was the other graduate assistant. And it was probably one of my best breaks I've had. I tell young guys all the time, if you can get on somebody's staff like Danny Casper early on, you'll find out, you know, whether you really want to coach. He'll push you hard. He'll be fair, but he'll teach you what it's all about. And so that was a great first year. We won a conference championship. My first season of coaching, still have that ring today, proudly displayed in the office.
And then you went to Abilene Christian. Why make the move over?
Well, it's a full-time job. So in Incarnate Word, I'm a graduate assistant, basically just making a couple hundred dollars a month, kind of surviving. And then Abilene Christian was a chance to get a full-time position with health insurance. Shannon Hayes was the coach at ACU at that time. You might know of him, Doug. He's got some Oklahoma State ties. Was Coach Dickey's assistant at Texas Tech later on, and his dad, Larry Hayes, was the all-time great baseball coach here at Texas Tech. So that was a great year, you know, being at the four-year level and finally getting a paycheck.
And then you went to North Texas?
Yeah, so back to the Texas roots, being at Texas as an undergrad. Vic Trilli was one of the assistants for Coach Penders, and that relationship got me to the Division I level. I think at the time I might have been the youngest full-time assistant in Division I. I only know that because my mom's got a Basketball Times article, I think, still in the house I read when I go home.
Those
two really good years with Vic.
What do your parents think this whole time? Like my dad's parents thought he was crazy. You know, his first job was he graduated from Columbia with a master's degree. And he went to coach at Fairlawn High School in New Jersey, where he replaced Hubie Brown. Like, my grandparents thought he was crazy. Like, actually had him talk to a psychologist, where they thought, because he loved basketball so much, like, there's something got to be wrong with this guy. What did your parents think when, here you are, great student in high school, good basketball player, and you think about leaving Texas, and then you're taking all these jobs. Like, what's the advice they're giving you at the time?
Yeah, same neighborhood, man. They think I'm crazy too. I do think my dad told me one thing early on, kind of like cliche advice, but it's true. You know, you try to find something that you love to do. It's obvious since a young age, I just love basketball. The cool thing about my old man though, he's so loyal. You know, he's like, you give him a t-shirt, he just like wears it till he can't wear it anymore. So as I changed jobs from time to time, I was like, Dad, you want to just kind of clear that out? I can get you a lot of gear now. You know, I'm at Texas Tech. We've got a pretty good budget. He's like, no, I still like that shirt. So I'll go home. He'll be wearing like an Incarnate Word shirt. Next day, Fort Scott Community College. Next week, Seminole, North Texas, Little Rock, South Carolina Warriors. He has them all. Like, he literally has like a closet full of t-shirts, but he's so stinking loyal that he won't get rid of them. He just keeps them in the rotation.
That's awesome. Okay, so you're what, 26 and you get the Fort Scott job, right? 26. What was the process like of your Division I assistant and you decide, I want to be a head? Like, did you decide I want to be a head coach? Did it just present itself? You know, why leave a Division I job and instead of trying to get another Division I job, go to JC?
You know, I spent a lot of time early in my career, and I still do, asking the advice of people that I respect. Like, just this past week on the road, you know, I run into Coach Wright, who's been so great to me since the Villanova game. Of course, they beat us. You know, it's easy to be nice to somebody you beat, but I, you know, try to, like, those 2 or 3 minutes I have with him between games, try to ask him something, you know, valuable, and spend some time with Bill Self this past week on the road. But always asking people kind of like advice on how to get through this deal. And early on, I think the thing that I realized was, like, everybody's advice was kind of different, and I came up with my own idea. You know, if there's no right path. If there was a right path to a head coaching job of success, everybody would take it. Well, I think you got to just kind of get a path that you're comfortable with and don't look back. You know, it's like I tell our players, there's no right decisions in life. You make the decision, then you make it right. And so with us, I was just sitting there, you know, at North Texas, really happy working for Vic, Division I level, really close to my hometown, Irving. We had good players. But I just felt like, you know, I got to get some head coaching experience. And I just thought that was important for so many reasons. Maybe at the top of the list that I wasn't a great college player. I just felt the need to get out there and to see if I could really get this done. So I just started applying for head coaching jobs. And Kevin Gundy, who was the AD at Fort Scott Community College, really gave me the break of all breaks and gave me a head coaching job at a young age. I went there, rolled up the sleeves, and kind of figured out, yeah, I can do this.
Okay, so your coaching philosophy at the time, you know, like all these different people that you played for, that you worked for, they all had a vast array of styles. But in your mind, we all kind of do this. Man, if I ever get a team, this is how I'm going to play. How'd you play it at Fort Scott?
Well, I've always believed in defense. You know, it started as a player. It's the way I could get on the court, be a guy that my coach could trust to defend and not foul and play the game the right way. My high school coaches were defensive-minded. Coach Penders, obviously defense with pressing and trapping and being aggressive. Danny Casper, one of the best half-court defensive coaches, and Vic, kind of a combination of both. So I came into that job knowing, like, hey, we're going to guard. And I'd recruited junior college for a couple of years, and I'd seen a lot of good, talented teams that looked the part, but they didn't guard. So I knew from day one, hey, we're going to defend. Whether that's pressure or contain, we'll see what kind of players we get, but we're going to guard. Then I've always been a guy that's just understand, man, look, you got to have the players. Like, what's happened here at Texas Tech, I appreciate everybody's compliments, and it means a lot to me. But at the bottom line is, you know, this past year we had 3 NBA players on our team, Keenan Evans and Zaire Smith. I think Zach Smith's right there as well. Just had a bad injury. And so, I mean, you know, this coaching deal is a little overrated. You better go get some guys that can play and want to play for you. And I learned that growing up, you know, at the park. We'd play at the park on the nights. And, you know, in Irving, we played at Conflans, and there'd be 35 guys deep, you know. So, like, it's your next game. You better win, or you're not going to play for another 2 hours. Now, if you're really, really good, somebody might pick you up, but I wasn't. So I learned at a young age, I better get with the best players here so we can stay on the court. So back to the junior college days, Fort Scott, we went out and got us some dudes. We had some real players. We taught them how to play defense. We had a good unselfish culture, and we went to work. Whenever I see those guys, I just saw Sean Mason the other day. His son is on the AAU circuit now. Sean played for us at Fort Scott, but almost kind of apologize to those guys. Like, hey, man, I wish I would have been a better coach back in those days. What I don't apologize for is how we treated them and how we guarded and how we tried to do things right. But obviously, I'm a better coach today than I was back in those days.
All right, you go to Seminole for a year. And then how did you get – tell me how the relationship with Coach Knight started. I know that he's really close to Danny Casper. I know – I mean, all those Texas guys. Bob Knight gets the job at Texas Tech. How'd you come aboard?
Yeah, it's a great story, you know, and I really didn't even realize how I'd gotten the job until I got here, and I was just kind of pinching myself and thanking Pat Knight every time I walked by his office. But it's so true. Like I tell our players all the time, you've got to treat everybody with class in life. You never know who's going to help you or who's going to hurt you. Every relationship's important. Everything matters. And the Texas Tech break for me was, you know, when I was coaching at Fort Scott Community College, Jerry Mullen, the nation's number one junior college guy, he lives in Kansas City, and Fort Scott happened to be maybe the quickest JUCO he could get to. So even without me knowing, he came to games from time to time, not only to evaluate our team, but basically to see who we were playing that night. So if Seward came to Fort Scott, that was his chance to watch Seward. And I think, you know, we coach right and we treat our guys the right way and we try to respect the game. And so when Coach Knight, he took that 1 year off from coaching, he was getting organized. He had two or three job offers, Texas Tech being one of them. He made a couple calls and he called Jerry Mullen and said, hey, I'm putting this team together. I think if I take X job, Y job, Z job, I might have to, you know, allow junior college players, especially at the first. And Coach Mullen, even though me and him didn't have a great relationship or didn't know each other well, he recommended me. He's like, hey, there's a young guy down at Fort Scott that's actually from Texas that I've seen his team play several times. So I thank Jerry Mullen a million times since then, almost to the point where he rolls his eyes when he sees me coming. But it's just a great example for all of us that sometimes the people that you don't even know well are the people that help you if you try to do things right.
Okay, but did you call? Did they call you? Did Coach Knight call you? Did Pat call you? Like, how did the contact begin?
Yeah, so I think Coach was really close to taking a job. There's about two or three on the table. I think Pat was coaching at Akron at the time, but he was starting to get organized, knowing he's going to make a move with Coach. And I just got a call one day. It was actually from Karen Knight, Coach's wife. She'd called the house before cell phones back in those days. I had the old school answering machine next to my bed. I'll never forget, it was like a Saturday morning after the season, so it's been like late March probably, and it's real, real early, like real early. Phone rings, and you can hear the message, like, hey, Chris, this is Karen Knight, Bob Knight's wife, and he wants to talk to you about a couple of players. Well, I thought it was a prank call. I got all sorts of buddies, man. We give each other shit all the time. I thought it was an absolute prank call, so I did not return the call. I didn't even blink at it. But later that afternoon when I got home from the office, there was another message. And you could tell Karen's voice was changing a little bit, like, hey, Chris, this is my second message to you. Then I started thinking, man, this might be, like, halfway legit. So I made a call, found out the coach's wife's name sure was Karen, and I called back that afternoon, probably made up some kind of excuse that I didn't get the messages. But basically, Coach was going around Duncan and looking at some of the best unsigned players in the country. Back in those days with the NCAA rules, that was completely legal because he didn't have a job. He came out to Seminole, spent some time with me, and, you know, and everything worked out. I got the job. One of our guys went to Tech with me.
When you did you know him before he came out to Seminole?
I did not. I never met him, but it obviously been a huge fan growing up. I mean, from Season on the Brink, the first book I ever read. I was supposed to read Where the Red Fern Grows in fourth grade, Miss Lovingworth, but I didn't read it. My brother had the Cliff Notes. First time I learned about Cliff Notes was in fourth grade. Not a big reader. Again, girls, movies, NBA basketball, reading wasn't on the list. But I did read Season on the Brink when that came
Me too.
Out, so I had an infatuation with Coach from day one.
Okay, so he shows up at Seminole. Like, did you play it cool? Did you meet him in his car? Like, what's – I mean, because I do think that one thing, and unfortunately with – you know, he might have coached a little too long, and they went to TV. And so I think people's perspective, when you say Coach Knight now, might be different of those of us who grew up loving ball, right? Like my dad used to, when he was Army, he used to go to his clinics. And then when he was at Indiana, he'd go to his clinics. I still have notes my dad took when he because he used to run an offense called the California Reverse, and I still have those notes that, my dad's house that my mom still keeps. So this is basketball royalty, shows up at Seminole Junior College at your school. You've only been a head coach for 2 years now at two different junior colleges. Do you remember anything about that meeting?
Absolutely. I remember Karen had called the night before and set up some like lodging for Coach, and I really was trying to encourage her to tell Coach to stay in Oklahoma City. I could come get him the next morning or whatever. Then it got back to me that, no, that's not how Coach rolls. He wants to stay right there in town, which now I understand, knowing Coach. He's not kind of like a big-time kind of, you know, perception guy. He's real, man. He would rather be at the Motel 6 than the Westin. I mean, that's just Coach Knight. That's why he's beautiful. But anyway, so he ends up staying. We have one hotel in Seminole at the time called the Seminole Inn, right across from the campus. Great dive bar in there, by the way. Like but that's not a part of the story.
No, that's good. Wait, what's the dive bar? This is a good. What's the dive bar?
It's just a great spot. They like dollar drafts on Wednesdays or something like that. Anyway, so back to Coach. I went over to pick him up that morning. It was like a maybe Monday, Tuesday morning at the time or something, and I never forget the door was just kind of cracked. And so I kind of knocked the door, and he's just like, come on in. And he's like drying off from the shower, and sit down there on the bed. And we like literally talking basketball 5 minutes into when I met him. But just the most down-to-earth guy, just loves basketball. Like he's the perception of what people think Coach Knight is and who he is just so far off. He's like a really, really good person that's easy to talk to and the whole deal, you know, when he's respects, I guess, the person he's with. Another great thing about that later that day after he'd watched our players and spent some time together, I told myself that I was going to kind of get the nerve up to ask him, you know, especially at the Texas Tech job happened, me being from Texas, you know, what was he going to do with his staff? I really wasn't like starstruck at the time because I'd met so many people, Lute Olson, Jerry Tarkanian, you name it, over the years in junior college. So really wasn't a starstruck deal. So I was kind of in my element. Got my courage up driving down to the Oklahoma City airport. This is before 9/11, so you didn't have to go through security. So I made it all the way to the gate. His flight leaves in like 30 minutes. I'll never forget. We're sitting at this little bitty round table. We're both eating pizza. People are coming up to Coach trying to get autographs. He's gracious. He does it. But when the food starts, he's politely telling people, hey, can you wait a second? We're eating. I finally get my courage up, Doug, and I was like, hey, Coach. I was like, I'm not sure what you're going to do with your staff, especially if you take the tech job, but I just wanted to tell you, I know you have a lot of people, anybody you wanted, but nobody, you know, would work harder, be more appreciative than me. And he kind of cut me off, and I'll never forget this. One of my great life lessons, I tell the players every year, I really believe this. Coach kind of looked at me. He was wiping the pepperoni kind of off his mouth, and he said, Chris, look, I've never been concerned with how hard somebody works. Like, that's a given. I'm much more concerned with who can get what done. And I'll never forget he said that. I tell everybody that I respect and everybody I coach that story. Because I think in our business, one thing I don't like is he's self-promoters. He's a worker. He works hard. I mean, we all work hard. If you're not working hard, you don't win. But what I'm really interested in with our staff is who can get things done.
Okay, so you get to Tech. And he takes over a program, and I knew it so well because we played against him, you know, and I love Coach Dickey. He's a good man. Obviously, they had some academic stuff, which caused them, you know, to not be able to have all their scholarships. And they weren't great, but they weren't bad either. So
right.
Look, that thing got going in like a year, right? I mean, first year, I think you guys made the tournament. When you look back at Tech and how Coach Knight turned that thing around so quickly, and I know Andre Emmett, some of those guys were already there. What were a couple of the things that he did and that you still to this day said, you know, that's the magic of what made Bob Knight?
Well, I think the first thing, you hit it on the head, you got to give Coach Dickey credit. We inherited all conference players and Andre Emmett, Andy Ellis. This always happens. You know, I try to tell people every chance I get how fortunate we were to follow Steve Shields at Little Rock and Tubby Smith at Texas Tech. It always perturbs me when a guy comes into a job and doesn't embrace or acknowledge what the last guy did. And Coach Knight was great about that. I remember vividly him talking to Coach Dickey on the phone one day, like a month or 2 months into us being in Lubbock. I thought that was one of the coolest things I'd ever seen. But we inherited good players. We also recruited very well right off the bat. Probably Kasib Powell, was a junior college player. We brought in Ronald Ross, one of the all-time greats, who's on our staff right now here at Texas Tech. So the combination of embracing and coaching and welcoming the returning players and then adding new players gave us a chance to be competitive. And then I'll never forget how just simplified coach made everything. Like every day we had some things we had to get done, and we got them done. He kind of eliminated all distractions. He had great people around him handling a lot of things, and coach just really focused on the basketball. But that first team was the biggest increase in wins in college basketball. We basically went from, I think, bottom of the Big 12 to third or fourth and made the tournament the first year.
In terms of recruiting, did he empower you? Did he say you can offer a player? Did he have to come see him? How did it work?
That's another great question. Man, he really trusted his coaches. People ask me that all the time, like, were you able to coach with coach? I mean, the answer is absolutely. I mean, you had to, or you wouldn't be here. He obviously having Pat on the staff was really special because he had such a trust factor with his dad and kind of knew exactly what we were doing. And as the other assistants, myself and Bob Byer at the time, we really relied on Pat to kind of point us in the right direction. And he did. You know Pat like I do, one of the most unselfish, best guys you'll ever meet. But back to coach, there was just a level of simplicity. You know, we're going to run the motion. We're going to play man-to-man. We're going to work hard every day. He was just kind of the master of keeping things simple.
He also kind of embraced the three-point shot. Like, he struggled with the – he hated the three when he was in Indiana. And you guys shot a lot more threes. Was that a discussion the staff had? Was that Pat pushing him to it? What changed?
That's a good question. From my point of view coming in, I just know that coach valued shot selection so strong. Like, that's probably the first thing about offense. He told me that one time on a long car ride back from, I think it was Dodge City, Kansas. And, Chris, the most important thing offense is shot selection. And,
yep.
You know, we had some good shooters. If you were a guy that could stroke it, he's going to let you shoot it. I mean, you're going to have the green light. But if you're a guy that's not a great shooter, you have to understand that, hey, we're going to get a good shot. But I think it's probably because the game changed a little bit and coach changed right there with it.
Was he, you mentioned he was great to work for, he let you coach. What was he like at that stage in his career for the players? You know, obviously he has a reputation of being super fiery and at times difficult to play for. When you watched him and how he treated his players, how would you relay that?
You know, like if you wanted to be coached and you wanted to get a degree and you wanted to win, then you had no problem with Coach Knight. It was the guys that kind of always had alternate deals where all coaches struggle with those players. But the thing about Coach, I mean, he wasn't going to sit here and try to be your best friend every day, but you knew he had your back. We've got Daryl Dorr on our staff now, and Daryl was one of the great players, played for Coach for 4 years. And Daryl has some stories that I didn't even know, but spending time with Daryl the last couple of years, like when Daryl was a freshman coming from Gonzales, Texas, it had kind of a tough life to that point. He said that a couple times Coach would check on him, a phone call, stop by the locker room after practice. Hey, Daryl, come here. I want to talk to you. These are the things that no one really understands. I mean, you're not the best coach in the history of the game without understanding the personal element, too. But Coach was never fake, but he was always real. And I think the players knew that he had their back. And, yeah, he wasn't easy to play for. But I think if you asked players at any school that wins like Coach did, I mean, nobody's easy to play for. I mean, it's competition at the highest level.
Okay, so you love Whataburger, right? I know that very well. I've listened to your press conferences. You always mention how much you love Whataburger. So I want you to first your order at Whataburger is what?
Breakfast, lunch, or late night?
Ooh, it's a good question. Breakfast, you go Bob? Do you go breakfast on a bun? Is that what you do?
No, I go taquito. Unsweet tea.
Okay, so but I thought unsweetened tea only existed on this earth for one purpose, and that was to be sweetened, but I could be wrong. Okay, let's do late night. So late night order at Whataburger is what?
Well, what you got to do late night is you got to see how many people are in there. You know, like if the drive-thru is really backed up, I'm going to go in. If you go in, you know, if you start getting fancy and stuff, you're going to have to wait longer. So really late night, I try to keep it really simple. I'll just go with the number one, mustard, pickle, cheese only. I'll go spicy ketchup. I'll go unsweet tea if my girlfriend's there. If she's not there, I'm going milkshake. And then if she asks me the next morning, do I get a milkshake? I'm probably white line.
Okay, so you get a milkshake. You get a number one. You're sitting in the corner, and you got some of your old players, and a couple of assistants, and just Texas basketball dudes. And I know that sometimes this will happen having a beer as well. But let's just picture Whataburger. All right, give me your best Bob Knight. Give me the one. All right, my go-to Bob Knight story. Go.
Oh, that's a good one, man. That is a good one. We had a, there's so many of them. Probably in that element, when the guys are around, you know, the kind of things they like to hear. One of the things we'd always do is at basketball camp in the summer. You know, coach was really involved in camp. A lot of these guys just kind of show up, shake hands, take pictures. Coach was there. I mean, he was there at all the sessions, and he was invested, and he would watch games and stuff. And that's one thing I always kind of looked up to him for. And we try to do the same thing with our camps here in the summers. I'd like to think that our staff is as involved as anybody. But anyway, back to the coach days, you know, like we always knew he would come in the mornings after stretch, and he would sit at the main table, and he would watch a little bit, maybe check some mail, be there. But he was going to be at that table early in the mornings, what he did. So we would always take the camp coach that we wanted to pick on, maybe the guy that had been out too late the night before, maybe the guy we were just trying to, you know, give a welcome to camp, and we would put him right in front of coach and give him like a defensive station or something. So like one year, it was actually a junior college assistant that me and Pat invited to come work camp. He was there, and we put him in front of like, I don't know, Lane Denial or Sheldrill or something right there in front of coach. Well, you know, we kind of left him out to dry because we didn't really tell him exactly how coach teaches things. And sure enough, every year, like clockwork, man, you just see coach sitting there, keeps glancing up, and eventually just gets to the point where he can't let mistakes go on. It's the way he coaches. And he would just get up and basically kind of rip the camp coach and stuff, and we'd be in the background watching the whole thing. But it was priceless every summer, and we could execute it every time we wanted to.
It's amazing. All right, so you decide you go back to being a head coach. When in South Carolina, didn't you go to the ABA before you got back to college?
Damn, Doug, you never heard of the South Carolina Warriors in Myrtle Beach?
Hey, man, I played for the – I don't remember – how about this? I played in Phoenix in the ABA. I don't know the nickname of the team I played for. I swear to God. I was in Israel, and Maz Track was a coach of the Phoenix team in the ABA. And I didn't like my coach in Israel. Like he was a good coach. We just butted heads, and like there's one Israeli guy Contour who could play, and they had to have an Israeli out in the court. And so the only guy who could really was replaceable was me, because otherwise all the other Israelis couldn't play. So like we would just butt heads constantly, and they would do shit like it'd be you're supposed to get paid on the first of every month, but they would wait until. They wait until like the shekel versus the dollar was a better ratio. They wait like 4 or 5 days and yep. Save like $70. And I was just getting pissed about it. So finally I go to them and I was like, look, I'll stay the whole time. And I would have had to stay and do like this basic training. But you have to promise me I'm going to get all my money. And the president of the club was like, we will do the best we can. I was like, come on, man. Just give me your word as a man. Look me in the eye and just say, I'll get you all your money. And he wouldn't do it. And so I start making calls to my agent. And I call Maz. And Maz is like, look, I'm going to cut. I got to cut my point guard. You can come. You can start for me. But, like, look, it's the ABA. It's really good ball. But you might get paid. You might not. But right. NBA scouts come and watch. So I know the NBA. I swear to God, I don't know the team, the nickname of the team. So you went and coached in the ABA in South Carolina. Did you get paid?
I did, sometimes. We had four owners in one season. I think two of the owners paid. It was always a little bit late, but... You know, the cool thing about that, though, is how pumped were you when you did get paid? You know, like, in normal jobs, you get paid every month. You know it's coming. But in the ABA, it's, like, awesome. Like, am I going to get paid? Am I not? And when you do, it's just like you hit the lottery, man.
Totally. Absolutely. Not only that, I remember my first – so I flew back from Israel. I joined the Phoenix team. They're in Detroit. We're playing the Detroit Dogs. I'll never forget this. People ask all the time, like, did you feel – because I went to – my ABA was 2003, I'm going to guess. Yeah, 2002. So I'd been in Israel right after 9/11. And people ask, well, did you feel safe there? And I tell them all the time, when I landed in Detroit and I went to the hotel, we stayed in downtown Detroit, Maz gave me $20 and said, that's your meal money for the day. And I had to walk to McDonald's, and it was like a 10-minute walk through downtown Detroit, and I felt less safe during that walk than I did at any time in Israel. But I ate McDonald's, and I balled out. We played two games, and a guy named Todd Bergen, who played at Syracuse, he stopped me. He's like, yo, DG, what's up, man? So we start shaking hands. He's like, he's like, where you been? I was like, I was in Israel. He's like, where were you? I was in Lebanon. I was like, how was Lebanon? He's like, oh, man, beautiful women, a lot of weed. I was like, all right, good luck tonight. Anyway, so South Carolina, four owners. But they also, did you guys have the three-point play if you stole it in the backcourt?
Yeah, I never got into that. You know, like we had a really good team with really good players because it was the year of the NBA lockout and guys just wanted to go play somewhere.
Yep.
Not only NBA players, but the whole world kind of froze, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a real training camp. Best basketball I've ever been a part of, seriously, was our training camp. We did 2-a-days for like 5 straight days. We had guys from Kentucky, North Carolina, Texas Tech, Coastal Carolina. And so we get down to the game the night before the game. We were at a Hard Rock Cafe doing this event for our owner. And George Tuttle, a West Coast guy, I think he's at Vanguard right now, was at Cal State Fullerton. Great coach, George Tuttle. He's like, Beard, are you ever going to talk to these guys about the four-point player, the 3D? I was like, George, I don't know. I'm kind of out of my comfort zone, man. I want to respect the game. Let's just play. So that night, we don't do anything. Well, now it's the next day. We're playing the first game in franchise history. We got the mayor of Myrtle Beach. He's throwing the ball up. We're in the old Coliseum downtown. It's actually pretty cool. Right before the game, I mean, like, right before the game, on the floor, Tuttle's like, man, do you mind if I say something? I was like, go ahead. So Tuttle's like, hey, guys, by the way, if you get a steal in the backcourt, this light's going to go off right here, and we get +1 for every basket. All right, good luck. Guys are just looking at him like, what are you talking about? So the game starts, and sure enough, it happens. Like, we're a little soft press. We get a steal, and that light goes on. You know, it's +1 for every point. But our guys don't know what's going on, but the fans are going crazy. So we get back to the huddle. You know, the other coach called timeout. We had basically gone on, like, a 6-0 run, but really it was, like, an 11-0 run in the ABA. And the players are like, what is going on? And I'm like, God, I'll explain tomorrow in practice. It's a true story.
Okay, so how'd you get the – so then you go to McMurray. And how much different of a coach are you, having been a head coach and then been an assistant for Coach Knight? You talked about when you saw the Fort Scott, when a couple of your guys from Fort Scott, you apologized, you wish you were a better coach. Did you feel different? Did you feel like completely at ease? How different was it you take over at McMurray?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've always thought about maybe like what do ADs think about when they hire people. And I think there is a lot of value in a guy that was a head coach at maybe a young age and then grinded it at that level, whatever, and then to come back, I think it's just like because you have a reference point for what you did before, then you obviously learn new stuff. And I don't know. You think about guys like a Steve Forbes and success he's having. There's just a lot of guys, a Chris Jans. There's a lot of guys out there like that. But back to my situation, I obviously had all this wealth of knowledge from Coach Knight and Pat for 10 years and just was itching to kind of get some of that stuff. But really, the ABA, I'd learned so much from the players. You know, like I'll be driving to the restaurant with, you know, Marquise Gaines from TCU and All-American. I just ask him, hey, vet, what was the best thing Billy Tubbs did or didn't do? So I had all this other information from the pro players. And so at McMurray, it was just like a big coaching clinic. I basically just kind of like slept in the office every night. I had so many ideas going through my head at that time. That's really where our philosophy that we're using now kind of formed.
It's amazing because having seen you coach in both games and practice, I'm blown away by a couple of things you do. You don't request, you demand eye contact every time you're speaking to the team. It seems like you, and I don't know if you intentionally do this, you use simple words or phrases continually, you know, kind of to embed them in their head in terms of how you want them to play. And so it's demanding and you're loud and you're coaching them in practice. But if you're around, like all you have to do is be through one practice. You're like, oh, okay, I get what he wants. I understand how he wants to be, how he wants to coach you. Is that kind of what you're talking about? Is that something that you developed? Can you talk about your coaching style now?
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. We mean in that. Like I've always said that coaching is like getting the information to the players and eventually getting it executed on the floor. I think there's a lot of guys who can sit in the hotel booth with you and talk basketball, but then they necessarily can't teach it on the floor. You know, communication's everything. So we do have a million ideas going through our heads, and anything that can help our players in any way, we're going to investigate and think about and research and try to maybe consider. But eventually when it gets to the court, we want it to be a simple situation for the players. You know, we don't want them thinking out there. We want them reacting and just playing the game. So we do have some code words we believe in, you know, whether it's money is what we call when we get an offensive rebound. So a money putback or a money pick and roll or a money three. The word money, something sacred to us. The word Tuttle, named after George Tuttle, is like basically our idea of transition, getting back or attacking when we get a steal. So keywords like a money or a Tuttle, these are things that really is the foundation of everything we do.
All right, so now you're at Tech after incredible success in a short period of time at Little Rock. And, you know, first year you inherit, as you've pointed out, good players, guys like Keenan from the previous staff, from Tubby's staff. But you go out and you grind, you find a kid like Zaire, you know, and Jared Culliver, another outstanding find for you. What's that like to find a kid that other people, that some of the services and some of the big schools might have missed on? Give him a great chance. He takes advantage of it. But then, you know, like a year in, now all of a sudden you've got to replace him. It's like a gift and a curse.
Yeah, this is kind of new to me. You know, Chris Ogden on the staff, we always kind of joked around Ogden. We called him Silver Spoon because, you know, he went to Texas, played Final Fours, coached, never left, did the 1 year at Tennessee. And Augie was the best about it because he would embrace it, never get his feelings hurt. He's like, hey, guys, I know. Like, what am I supposed to do? Not stay at Texas? And we'd all laugh. But we'd tell Augie some stories about JUCO or D2 or the low majors or struggling, and Augie would always be kind of like, interested in those stories, but we'd always call him Silver Spoon. Well, now, but he'd always told me, Beer, there's problems on the other side of the tracks too, man. Like, you know, and I said, oh, I understand. I respect that. I said, I just wish I could kind of try to deal with those problems from time to time. Well, be careful what you ask for. You know, Zaire was special. We're so supportive of him. We were the 16th pick in the draft. You got to go. That's a no-brainer. But now we're on the other end of this deal, living the world where we're trying to figure out how to, you know, it's hard to go out and replace Zaire in May when he declares. So, this is the other side of it, and I have a great appreciation for everybody in basketball, always have, but now I understand a little bit more what the Kentuckys and Villanovas and Texas do when you lose guys from the one and done. There's a whole other side of that. And so, you know, Augie was kind of like a fortune teller. Beer, there's other problems on the other side, and he was certainly right.
You know, obviously recruiting transfers is something you have to do and something that you've been able to do to be successful. Others in the Big 12 are using it as well. Do you have any couple of things you do other than calling the guy's previous coach? Is there anything you do to know what you're getting? Like, that's a hard thing because sometimes these things happen fast. Kid comes available. He's interested in Tech. You watch some tape. You talk to some people, and then you got to make a call really, really quickly because sometimes if you don't offer him right away, the kid gets upset and he's like, why didn't you offer me right away? Even if you're doing your due diligence, do you have a process you go through to know what you're getting?
Absolutely. One thing we really believe in is the video. You know, I tell the guys all the time, let's don't be YouTube guys. Like, don't bring me a 3-minute YouTube and tell me about the player. You got to dig in. You got to work. At the end of the day, even though we live in this world where everything's easy, social media and cell phones and Uber Eats. How about that one? I can't get past that one. But it's still value and just old school work. So, I mean, we're going to lock up and we're going to watch every game that kid plays. So, like, Matt Mooney, coming from us from South Dakota, I've seen basically every game Matt played in his college career. And I think that's important for a lot of reasons, not just our evaluation process, but also I think the player needs to know, like, hey, this coach knows me. He knows of my journey. He knows where I've been. He knows why I'm transferring. You know, I think that's important. Another thing with us with the transfers, it's just something I really, really believe in, and it goes back through my whole career, whether it be JUCO, one-year guys, D2, one-year guys, ABA, one-week guys, one-month guys. I just think that we have an ability. I don't think we're any better than anybody else, but I don't think anybody's better than us in coaching guys in one-year settings. I just believe in it. I think we get relationships with guys quickly. We understand and we embrace the idea, like, hey, man, you've got 31 more games guaranteed. This is it. I think there is an art to coaching a guy in a one-year setting, and I think we've been really good about it. And I'm not talking about just Texas Tech. I'm talking about way back at Fort Scott Community College when I had Jamal Brown for 1 year, or at Seminole State when we had Will Jones for 1 year, McMurray when we had Dakobe Jackson for 1 year. I think we're good at that. And I hope it doesn't come off as arrogant or boastful, but it's really confidence and belief. I think we're as good as it gets when you got 1 year to coach a guy. I think we get it.
What's Bransma doing? Because Thomas Bransma, he followed you around school to school, right?
Bransma update, yep. So Bransma got done playing. The NBA was not calling. He went to the oil fields of West Texas and made a bunch of money right out of the gates. lived in a trailer in Pecos, Texas, was throwing water line out there, made a lot of money.
What is throwing water line? I live in Southern California, man. I'm from Orange County. What is throwing water line?
Yeah, so basically, I'll kind of give you the junior college version here. It's like, you know, the oil boom's going on out here. So basically, you need water. You need water to get the dirt right. You need water to clean things. You just need water, but there's not a lot of water out here. So they basically just bring water in from different sources. So there's so much oil and so much business out there. You know, there's just like unlimited work. So a guy like Bransma, who was in our program for 5 years and understands a little bit about hustle and getting after it, you know, he just gets out there and sees an opportunity and seizes it. So they're making all sorts of money out of the gates. Then he gets hooked up. I think he falls in love with a girl from Stephenville, Texas, which was concerning to me because that's where Tarleton was, and we were at Angelo State. That was our rival. And I was like, Bransma, you're dating a rival. He's like, Coach, you can't fight love. So I understand that. So I think with the relationship and with the fact that he made a little bit of money out of the gates, now he's in, like, the real world. He's back in Lubbock. He's working a business job that has a kind of an incentive-based salary, which is good for Bransma because the competitiveness is still there. But here is, as of lately, he's been poking around the office a little bit more than normal, kind of with that, like, look on his face where I think he's maybe thinking about getting the basketball disease back. Yeah. But doesn't have the balls enough to ask me yet. But I can see it in his eyes that I think he's going to be coming into me pretty soon talking about maybe getting into coaching.
Okay, so, and for people who don't know, Thomas Bransma, he started with you at McMurray, followed you to Angelo State, then went to Little Rock, and then, of course, you took the UNLV job for like 10 days, and then the Texas Tech job, which you've told everybody it's your dream job. Of course, you know, it's like a little over an hour from your daughters. You go right back. He followed you to all those stops, and, of course, I mean, like, I think the least you could do is you know, find a grad assistant role for him, right, or something, if he wants to get back in this crazy business.
That's one side of the story. Some people think that, you know, we owe Thomas, but I'd be quick to tell you, I mean, Thomas kind of benefited from our program too. I mean, the guy goes from being a Division II school, paying $30,000 tuition, until he scored a basket against West Virginia. Can you imagine what his nightlife was that night? I mean, the guy has benefited from our program, too. So there's no doubt that I appreciate everything Thomas has done, but I think Thomas would be the first to tell you he appreciates what the program's given him, too. I mean, this girl from Stephenville, Doug, is not bad-looking. You know, I mean, Thomas's life is going in the trajectory, and I would like to think that our program had a little bit to do with it.
That's a beauty. That's an absolute beauty. All right, last thing. We're waiting on these new NCAA rules to determine what's open period, what's not open period. You and your staff, you guys are old school grinders, right? Like you want to go watch kids play. You want to offer them a scholarship. You don't pay kids. You don't change their grades. Like that's kind of the easy baseline rules to it. If I put you in charge, would that just be simply the rules? Do we need other periods so that guys are around campus? Like how would you do it if they said, hey, Chris, you've coached at all different levels of college basketball. You know the right way to do it. How would you do it?
I don't think there's anything wrong with our game now, though. I think, like, obviously we have some problems, but everybody has problems. The business world has problems. I mean, I still go back to the fact that we have a great game where that NCAA tournament and Final Four is simply the best. College basketball produces leaders and good husbands and good men. I mean, I love our game. It's beautiful. Do we have flaws? Of course, but everything has flaws. I think with the recent FBI deal and all that, it brings light to some of that stuff. But I think there's another million good positive stories out there as well. I know this too. Coaches are going to adjust. You can change the rules from 3 weeks to two to no April to May. But like, eventually we're all basketball guys and we're going to adjust. And my big view of things, and nobody asked me ever, but you are, so I'll take advantage of it. I just think you got to put the control of the game back in the college coach's hands. And to do that, you got to let the college coaches be with the players, go recruit the players, spend time with them. But it's crazy to me that I can only work with my guys 2 hours a week in the summer.
And as you know, and people, I'm sorry to cut you off, but like this idea, well, 20-hour week or 2 hours in the off season. Like, look, if you do too much, you're going to lose the player anyway. So you have to measure how much you do. And you can't.
Right.
And as much as people say, well, you're going to kill a kid and working him out, like, no, you're not. You're going to, he's going to be in the gym regardless. Why not be in the gym under the watchful eye of a guy who's been doing it like you for 20, 25 years and knows how to take a player from point A to point C, right? I mean, doesn't that make sense?
It does to me. And then when you don't let the coaches work with the players, it's where the outside people come in. And I don't blame the players. Like, I mean, look, Jared Culver is going to get in the gym 4 or 5 hours a day, 7 days a week in the summer. That's who he is. It's his DNA. And I can work with him 2 of those hours. And the other hours, I mean, he's still going to be in the gym. So I just don't understand it. I think, I mean, I would trust the Bill Self and Coach Williams and Coach Huggins. And I would put the game in Tom Izzo's hands. That's what I would do, because I think at the end of the day, all of us coaches, you know, are doing this for the guys, man, like we are. Like, I'm not convinced there's, like, a lot of bad guys in our business. I just don't believe that. I think most coaches love their players. They want to win. And they're gonna work their guys accordingly. So that's my big, big picture thing, is I don't know why they don't just put it in the coach's hands. I mean, maybe I'm not in the room. I understand. But why wouldn't you get Coach Izzo and Coach Self and Coach Williams and Coach Huggins and Coach Kruger? Why wouldn't you get these guys in a room and ask them, hey, what does the game need? To me, it's that simple. But, you know, you're talking to a guy that, you know, lived around the BC average.
I said last thing, I lied. One more. You guys came so close against Nova. I mean, you guys did the best job against them defensively. You miss drives, you miss finishes. And I know they do a great job of bumping you with their lower body, and you're playing so hard defensively against all the different stuff they do, that I think that, and the pressure takes away from some of the shooting. But as you self-assess, is there anything you come out of that Elite Eight game thinking you could have done personally better?
Yeah, you hit it. The whole night of finishing. I think Villanova did a great job, like, keeping their upper bodies extended where they're not fouling. Lower body might pop you from time to time, but to me that's good. It's good coaching. We had 7 drives in the second half, and we went 0 for 7. You got to make a couple of those. You got to draw a foul on a couple of those. And, you know, look, we're a no-excuse program. Some people talk to me about officiating that game, but I'm not buying that. I mean, we just got to get to the point where we make those guys call those fouls. But really, and we've already tried to embrace that. We started in the spring and the summer working on finishing around the basket, 1 foot, 2 feet, lower, upper, more than ever. And then just I do think we were ready to play that night. A lot of people say, well, is it just because Villanova had been in that moment? Y'all haven't. I'm not buying that either. We were relaxed. We were ready. We just didn't play well enough offensively. We held them to 33% shooting. If you'd have told me before the game we could do that, I'd totally see in San Antonio. But we just couldn't manufacture enough offense. But ultimately, you got to give Villanova for credit. They were just so hard to score against. Maybe the best defense we played against all year was Villanova.
Yeah. And obviously for you, it's one thing for anybody to get to the Final Four, but to you to get to the Final Four in the state of Texas at Texas Tech would have been incredible. But without a loss, you know, it doesn't, not sometimes there's more to learn from a loss than there is from a win. Hey, you've been more than gracious with your time. I know you got to figure out what you want to do with Bransma, if you want to add him to staff. I know you got to you got to send me more videos of Sean Sutton, you know, walking around and forgetting things in his room. I appreciate you joining us, and I look forward to catching up with you in person really, really soon.
See you soon, Doug.
That's All Ball, the All Basketball Podcast here on the Herd Podcast Network. I hope you enjoyed Chris Beard. We'll have another conversation for you next week. Thanks so much for joining us. Don't forget to listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app, or Sirius XM Channel 83, and download, subscribe, and rate All Ball.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
You never want to find yourself out on the water fishing without the essentials. So it's best to always pack a Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie to protect against the sun. I mean, it provides great protection and it's really breathable so you don't get hot. That's a win-win. Columbia PFG has a lot of great gear. So before you head out on the water, head over to Columbia.com/PFG to shop their performance fishing gear.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.